When I was initially working on this sermon, as evidenced by the description of the worship service from January, when we got snowed out, I thought the focus was going to be more on our first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. But the more I've worked through it, and the more I found the story to be about the seventh principle, the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, and respect for that. Now that's quite a mouthful. You know, the song version is "The web of life's the way." I'm like, oh, that's so much easier. But the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. You'd think it could be shorter, even the grown-up version, just the interdependent web. But humans sometimes aren't that good at recognizing the bigger story, especially when we're in pain or mad or afraid. And that's when we need to remember it the most. And us Unitarian Universalists in particular, sometimes we like to believe that we're exceptional to the point of being set apart from others, removed from the things that we think we've rejected or left behind as our tradition has progressed. So we need this big mouthful of a reminder that we are deeply, deeply set into this web of existence, whether it's moving us to joy or to sorrow. The interdependent web of all existence, even the pieces we don't like. The interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. We are intimately, inextricably connected to the people we dislike. Dare I say it, we are inextricable from those that we hate. As much as we don't want to hate people, we're human. It happens. We are a part of those whom we try to shut out and disown as not being us. And this brings me to the reading today, often titled "The Faith of the Canaanite Woman." I like to call it "Scraps from the Table." But I think it should have a subtitle, which is "In Which Jesus is Wrong." I love this story. I love it. It's one of the best stories for somebody like me, who is a perfectionist, like pathologically perfectionist. I overfunction all the time. It's one of the things I'm constantly working on. And I've spent years, right? Yeah, he works with me, right? He knows. I've spent years learning that mistakes are inevitable, that we are flawed beings, always learning how to be better to each other. And there's lots of different interpretations of this story in Christian exegesis, and lots of different ways of working the text for many of them so that Jesus is still perfect. Perhaps those versions of the story speak to you, and that's okay. That's just fine. But we're not going to talk about those today. One of the things I love most about Unitarian Universalism is that not only do we embrace different stories, we embrace different sides of the same story. We say yes, and what's next? So this morning, we're focusing on the idea that Jesus was wrong. He gets called out on it. And instead of doubling down in his wrongness, who here hasn't done that, right? Yeah. Throwing a tantrum, also done that. Or any other kind of deflecting behavior, he says, "Oh my gosh, you're right. Good grief." And then he makes amends. "I made a mistake. You're right. I'm sorry. I'm going to fix it." So think about the power dynamics here in this story, okay? A desperate woman from an oppressed, systematically maligned population, that's what the Canaanites were, shows up asking for help for her child from a healer. And this healer, who knows, whatever you think about Jesus, in this version of the story, he can do this and he knows that he can do it. He can ease this child's suffering. He says, "No, I don't think so. You don't have your insurance card. You are not the right kind of people. In fact, I'm not sure you're even a person. You're like a dog." Well, I just want to point out, for many in this congregation, that's not an insult.
Okay. We love our dogs in this congregation. We even have a dog on our lay ministry team. But apparently, this is an insult for Jesus. That's another sermon. And this woman, who has already made herself vulnerable just by showing up and begging for help, she doesn't back down. She says, even dogs get scraps from the table. Even dogs are part of a household. She says, even if I'm willing to debase myself to agree with your assessment of me as less than you, I'm still a part of the interdependent web, and you should respect that. I am willing to believe in you and your power to save my child. Why won't you believe in me? And there it is. Jesus realizes that he actually knows nothing about her life or what difficult choices she had to make to survive. He has judged her worth solely on her identity as a Canaanite. He reacts like a bigot. Now, this is not to say that the Canaanite woman is perfect. We don't know anything about her. We don't know anything about her past behavior or her choices. She could be toxic in any number of ways, but not just because she's a Canaanite. And that's the point of the story, that in this moment, it doesn't matter. Anything that she's done or may have done doesn't matter. In that moment, she is asking for help for someone she loves, from someone she knows can help, at no risk or loss to himself. Everything else is irrelevant. So how does this tie into Guardians of the Galaxy? Don't worry, I'll do it. I love genre stories because they help us get understanding about our own lives by removing us from it. When Nichelle Nichols, who played Uhura on the original Star Trek series, was considering leaving the show, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King asked her, Martin Luther King Jr., asked her to stay on. He told her how important it was for Black people, especially young Black children, to see themselves on television as something other than a servant. Star Wars tells us a story about the search for identity and resisting imperialism. I'm not the only one with props today. Superheroes awe us with their powers while teaching us how to process the power of our own emotions and our actions in the world. And sometimes those heroes are anti-heroes. The Guardians of the Galaxy are our Canaanites. And unlike the Canaanite woman from our other story, we know all about the history of this motley crew of criminals. Peter Quill, aka Star-Lord, he's a con man and a thief. He was kidnapped from Earth as a young boy after the death of his mother and maintains emotional distance from those around him as protection. His only connection to that part of his life where he experiences love is the songs that he has on the one tape that he has, the songs that you're hearing here today. Gamora, a thief and assassin for hire. Her family was killed in front of her when she was a child, and she was adopted by the man who did it. He turned her into a living weapon. She's fighting to survive and to find a way out. There's Drax, a man consumed by a need for violent revenge after the slaughter of his family. He solves problems by hitting things, a lot. And then there's Rocket the Raccoon. He's a freak, a mistake made from the progress of science without the tempering of ethics. He is, more than any of the rest of them, alone in the universe, carrying memories of torture and abuse, and living with the constant ridicule and mocking of those around him every day. He is cruel and angry. All of them created by the systems in which they exist. All have had to live for most of their lives with no one validating their inherent worth and dignity. So they are forced to carve it out for themselves in small, minute ways whenever they can, often resorting to brutality, fear, and avoidance rather than seeking right relationship. And yet, when push comes to shove, when they realize that they can contribute in a meaningful way to the larger community, to the survival of the very people who malign and oppress them, they rise to the occasion. And then there's Groot. Oh, I love Groot. The giant tree being. Groot is Rocket's muscle, giving him physical and emotional support in a world that created him and then abandoned him. While Groot can only vocalize the words, "I am Groot," he understands everything said to him. Groot becomes the force binding this group together, the one among them who can create beauty amongst profound ugliness. You have to know how awfully these people have been treated to understand how huge it was for them to join the fight to save the world that had abused them. You have to know how criminal their choices have been to understand the risk they took by contacting the Nova Corps, the military and police forces of the first planet to be attacked. You have to know how little they think of themselves, how little they expect from their lives, to understand how shocking it was that Groot sacrificed himself to save them. In that moment, when Groot uses "we" for the first time, he is using his power to heal those he cares about. He is telling them, "You showed up, and you are worth saving." So where do you find yourself in this story? Maybe you're one of this mercenary crew asking for someone to believe in you, to believe that you can change the world even as it's trying to tear you down. Maybe you're one of the Nova Corps having to decide whether or not to give these people a chance to believe in them, to believe that they can save your planet despite their history. And I know that there are people, that there are relationships that are so toxic, we must one-on-one break those ties for our safety and for the safety of others in our care. I've had to do this myself. There are people I can never let back into my life. One person cannot take down a Ronin or hold an Infinity Stone, bent on destroying everything just because that they can. And people like this do exist. Let us never forget that. But these toxic, destructive people remain part of our interdependent web. Even if we can't be in direct relationship with them, we will always be in indirect relationship with them. And so by pouring out all the love and kindness we can muster out into that web of all existence, we can support them from a distance. We can change the world until it changes what's around them. A large, healthy system like the one this congregation has worked so hard to become is strong enough to take a risk as a community when the risk is too great for one single person to bear. Like our criminal protagonists and the Nova Corps, we are stronger when we work together to fight a common enemy for the good of all. Like Jesus, we have the power to heal those who come to us, who willingly join with us. And here's the really difficult part of the story for us to bring into our daily lives. After the Guardians defeat Ronin, boo, after they save the planet, stop the spread of destruction to the rest of the universe, the Nova Corps erases their criminal records, builds them a ship to replace the one they lost in battle, and then lets them go free. They are given a clean slate and the chance for a new beginning. The past is forgiven, but not forgotten. There is an understanding that if they break this new covenant, there will be repercussions. But until that happens, they will be treated like any other member of the community. I love this because it's not some magic erasure that gets rid of everything about their lives and personalities. They are still fundamentally the same beings they were before. Your past, my past, our past is always part of who we are. Their personalities have not changed, but now they have a vision of the future in which they are empowered to possibly make better choices. The sequel hasn't come out yet, so I'm sure we're going to see some bad choices yet to come. Otherwise, there's no plot. They're flawed. We're flawed. But the possibilities are there. And as the story of the Canaanite woman tells us, even Jesus was flawed. Groot was flawed. We can be flawed and still be powerful, powerful beings, co-creating the universe, one choice at a time, one healing outreach at a time. We can still recognize and respect the ways in which we are connected to one another, from our closest friends and family, to strangers on the other side of the globe, to the people we think of as enemies. We are all in this together. We can heal the world if we're willing to reach out and believe, because we are Groot.